Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 69. What if the worst case scenario came true?
I had almost given up hope that he was going to ask me out. I was like, he just thinks of me as a friend. This is it. And I was saying that to my friend, my best friend on the phone, when I got a call waiting. And it was him asking me, telling me, my dad told me I should probably ask you out to dinner. So I said yes. And, I think we've been together longer than we've been apart at this point. 17 years we've been together. So that was kind of the beginning. So we live in a suburb of a mid-sized city in central New York. What you would picture when you picture an idyllic sort of Leave It to Beaver suburb. I was the feminist girl who thought, oh, I'm not going to get married young. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to have, you know, adventures, and I'm going to do things on my own. And, you know, I ended up being the one wearing the engagement ring my senior year in college. Not that it stopped me from having adventures and doing interesting things. It didn't, you know, but, you know, it was just a unexpected turn in life that I got engaged so young. So we waited till we were 24 to get married. So we'd been together 6 years at that point. And we actually moved back to our hometown. I knew he was the one probably from the moment we started dating. And I think that terrified me a little bit because I was so young. But that just happened to be how things worked out. And thank God. What if I'd run? You know, what if I'd say no? I'm only 19. I don't want to do this. But luckily I didn't run. I became a teacher directly out of college. I was fortunate enough to be hired in the position that I still hold today, the day after graduation. Got engaged at 21. I started my career at 22. We were 23 when we bought our first home, again, back in our hometown. Everything that I had always hoped was going to happen was starting to happen. We didn't start thinking about having kids for a few more years when we were 27. I always wanted two kids. We had always talked about two kids, and I figured 28 and 30 were the right ages to do that. Again, that's my A-type personality. Like within a week of conception, I felt different. I felt special. Like, and I don't really know how to describe it in any other way. But I remember driving home and feeling like something is special about me right now. You know, it was just a really happy time. I remember going to my grandfather's 90th birthday celebration. And, you know, here we are celebrating someone who's made it to 90 years old. And I'm bringing a new life into this world with my husband. And just, it was around Christmas time. So everything just felt really magical, and that the next Christmas we would have this little baby. In almost everything in our life, we are so very fortunate. Totally typical pregnancy, you know, sick as a dog for the first 16 to 20 weeks. I felt like, you know, those first couple of weeks I was so happy that I was pregnant, and I thought, I don't even feel a little bit nauseous. Oh, this is going to be a breeze. And then the nausea hit. Things progressed pretty normally, and there he was. He was finally there. You have all these visions of how you're going to be the perfect parent, and you know exactly how to do that. I was very, very wrong. You know, he had horrible colic for the first 4 months of his life, so he just cried and cried and cried, and the only thing that calmed that kid down was the vacuum. The vacuum cleaner. We would run the vacuum cleaner just for hours. And finally, after 4 months, that improved. I think I needed that little slap in the face to say to me, you know, have some humility here. I read a quote somewhere where someone said, being a mother is like wearing your heart on the outside of your body. And it's so true. Like, the most precious things that you have are outside of you and you can't protect them. And that is a lesson I very much needed to learn before my daughter came along, because I completely lost control when she came along. You know, we were just looking forward to that same experience with baby number two and giving our son a sibling, and we were lucky enough to get pregnant right away again, and I was hoping for a daughter this time. You know, everything was going along seemingly normally. My second child, she just wasn't as big a mover as my son had been. So I couldn't always count on feeling her as regularly. But I especially, you know, at this day, I was really caught up in, I think I was teaching the crucible. Maybe halfway through the day, I stopped. I had a moment to just think. And I thought, you know, I haven't felt her yet today. Something inside of me, like a little twinge, gave me just like a little nudge. Like, I've always been a worrier. I've always been an anxious person. So a lot of times I have to talk myself off the ledge, like, you know, calm down. That afternoon I went to it was just a regular checkup at the OBGYN. So she puts the Doppler onto my belly and, you know, we're chatting, laughing as she's searching for the baby's heart rate. And then all of a sudden she says, stop, stop, be quiet. Shh, shh, I have to listen, be quiet. Babies in utero, their heart rates are supposed to be between like 120 and 160. My baby's heartbeat was just thumping along in the 80s. The midwife, you know, listens and listens, and she says, okay, you know, there's so many reasons that this could be, but just as a precaution, we're going to send you over to the hospital. Have you looked at, and, you know, it'll probably be nothing. And as we're driving to the hospital, that twinge happens again. Everything is not right. And I'm trying my best to ignore that intuition. I'm trying to say, no, you're overreacting. The nurse comes over and she, puts the Doppler on again, and she can't find the heartbeat at all. And of course, I'm gripping the bed just in terror. This doctor brings over an ultrasound machine, and there she is. She, you know, jumps up onto the screen, heart beating. She's there. But her heart rate is still in the 80s. Still, something is still wrong. And the doctor just won't give me an answer, won't give me a straight answer, won't look me in the eye. In comes the nurse again. She, this nurse and the doctor and some orderlies come into my area. They're unlocking the locks on the bed that I'm laying on. And the nurse throws these papers onto the bed and says, I need you to sign these. And I'm like, what are they? And she says, they're the release forms for you to have your emergency cesarean section. And I'm like, what? She's like, we're going to take you for an emergency cesarean right now. As she's saying this to me and like holding the pen, we're walking, I'm being wheeled out of the triage towards an operating room. No one has told me anything about what's going on. I'm 30 weeks pregnant. I mean, this is 10 weeks early. My baby's heart is doing things it shouldn't be doing. And my husband's not even here at the hospital. They transfer me onto the operating table. I'm like, somebody tell me what's happening, please. And I'm shaking uncontrollably. I can hear my teeth clacking together. I'm shaking so hard. Oh, we need to get your baby out immediately. You know, something is going on with her heart. We feel like we can take care of her better in the NICU than what she's doing in, you know, in your belly right now. So they're going to put me under. And then before I woke up from surgery, they were going to transport my baby to a different hospital to be put in the NICU. From what I'm being told, I'm facing the likelihood that my daughter is going to die when she's born, and I'm never going to see her. I keep saying, I have to be able to see my baby. I have to be able to see her, you know, before she goes. And then, all of a sudden, I can hear my OB, my personal OB. I can hear her in the hallway outside of the operating room, and I can hear her yelling orders at people. Get me, you get me an ultrasound machine in this operating room right now. No one is touching her until I look at this baby. She's like Wonder Woman, right? She like bursts in through the operating room doors. She comes over to me. She's holding my hand. Don't worry, I'm here. No one's touching this baby until I look at what's going on. She puts the ultrasound machine on there and she says, you know, Aaron, we're not taking this baby today. This baby is staying where it is. And she's like, babies who are in real trouble, they stop moving. She's like, they stop moving so that they conserve every amount bit of energy that they have to stay alive. She's like, your baby is partying. Within half an hour, I go from being on the operating room table, ready to be put under, to being released. My doctor's walking me out of the hospital saying, the decision that I made to leave your baby, I don't know if that's the right decision. I can't make any guarantees. I don't know if your baby is going to be here with us tomorrow. I need you to be my human baby monitor. She's like, I need you to count kicks every hour. And if you start to feel like, you know, she's not moving as much, I need you to get back to the hospital immediately. You know, it's nighttime. I go up to go to bed and I fall asleep, which seems like, oh, that's a good thing, right? But I'm supposed to be counting kicks every hour. And when I wake up, it's 2.5 hours later. And I'm terrified because I didn't count the kicks for the last 2.5 hours. And I don't feel her moving when I wake up, shaking my belly around, trying to wake her up in there. You know, come on, baby, wake up, show mommy that you're okay in there, you know, and nothing, nothing. I slurp down a bunch of apple juice and I eat a bunch of chocolate and I wait. And, you know, 1 minute, nothing, 2 minutes, nothing, and you know, 10 minutes. I mean, she's jiving in there. She is wired on sugar, you know, and she's just jumping up and down in there. And I am just so relieved, you know, like, okay, she's in there. She's moving. You know, this isn't the night I'm going to lose my baby. So this continues, this human baby monitor routine of me waking up hourly, 8 weeks of not knowing whether she's going to live or die, 8 weeks of no sleep, no consistent sleep, 8 weeks of just, it felt like mental torture. We had a scheduled cesarean. So this could be a really joyful day, or it could be the worst days of our entire life. My doctor, again, she's just such a wonderful and caring person, and she's talking to me the whole time, and she finally says, okay, you're going to meet your daughter. And it just feels like forever. I mean, it was probably 10 seconds, but it felt like an hour, just holding our breaths, waiting. And in that 10 seconds, all of a sudden, you know, we hear her screaming her lungs out. There she is, and she sounds healthy, that's for sure. It was the most beautiful sound I'd ever heard. She was just screaming at the top of her lungs. I begged. I said, please, please, before you take her, just let me see her, you know, in person. Let me kiss her. Let me tell her I love her. And so they bring her over, and she's wrapped in her little blanket. And she, again, you know, that squishy
ugly little newborn face, but so beautiful to mom, you know. And I get to kiss her, and then they take her, and they, you know, they go to the NICU. It just felt like everything from those 8 weeks, I could feel it starting to shed away, you know, like I had done what I was supposed to do. I kept her alive. We had this hope that when she came out into the world, that like the bright colors and the loud noises and the smells and the tastes and the touches, that they would wake her up, and that all of a sudden her heart would be beating like a normal baby's heart. And we had this hope this whole time, but it didn't happen. You know, she stayed down in the 70s and 80s. We still had no answers, like nothing. None of the tests came back positive for anything. So they sent us home. And honestly, I don't remember a lot of her first year of life. I was later diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. But the snippets that I do remember are of me crying just all the time, just weeping 20 to 30 times a day, just weeping. It was both postpartum depression and post-traumatic stress disorder from the trauma of the pregnancy. I really wasn't functioning beyond, I was taking care of my children, but I wasn't taking care of myself. You know, I wasn't showering. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. Every time I tried to close my eyes, I thought, what if she wasn't there when I woke up? And being inconsolably frightened, just of things that were not realistic fears. Things like, what if there was a fire at night and I couldn't get her out of the house, or I couldn't get my son out of the house? What if I was driving them somewhere and the car spun out of control and went over a bridge and I had to choose which one of my children to save? What if I was so tired that when I was bathing her or my son, I fell asleep and they drowned in the tub? That fear had spun out of control to the point where I was fearing everything. I was fearing, what if my husband gets in an accident on the way home from work and I'm a widow with two children? What if, you know, everybody has those moments where they think of, oh, what if this happens and I can't deal with it? But this had become the center of my universe, were these fears. I could not stop thinking about these fears. I was crying, like I said, 20 to 30 times a day. I would break down in tears to the point of dehydration sometimes. I don't remember what she looked like. I don't remember people coming over and meeting her. I didn't know that what I had was postpartum depression, and so I didn't know to get help until maybe 6 weeks, 7 weeks after she was born, going into her room to breastfeed her at 3 a.m. And you know, the room was dark and I was rocking in the rocking chair and nursing her. I was coming up with a very serious plan for how to protect her if vampires tried to attack her. I was very sure of the fact that vampires really liked newborn baby blood, and that my daughter was so sweet and beautiful that she was obviously going to be a target for vampires. And how would I stop the vampires from getting her? And I came up with a plan of how I would sacrifice myself to vampires in order to save my child. In my fear-addled mind, that was a very real fear for me. And the next morning, when I woke up, I said to myself, you need help. I was very fortunate because antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications worked beautifully for me. I couldn't stop what was hurting her. I couldn't fix it. I had to let go of all of my control. And every time we went there, you know, our doctor would say, I've never seen anything like this before. Even the experts don't know what's wrong with your child. So my mind is filling in the blanks with the worst possible answers. I would try to take comfort in the maybes. Well, maybe this is what it is. Maybe it's just that this is how she is, and there's nothing really wrong. It's just that she's kind of an outlier on the bell curve. When she was maybe 7 or 8 months old, our cardiologist said, "So I have a theory that, you know, I want to run past you." And she's like, "You know, it's very unlikely that this is the cause of her bradycardia, but I did some research and I found an article that links bradycardia, which again is the slow heart rate, to long QT syndrome." No clue what long QT syndrome was. And she said, don't Google it. Do not Google long QT syndrome because it will just scare you. She's like, it's probably not what it is. This is our worst case scenario. But yeah, I just want to eliminate it from the possibilities. I, of course, immediately Googled it. And of course, I had terrified myself because it's a terrifying syndrome. It's one of the sudden arrhythmia death syndromes, which the acronym for that is SADS, which is like the worst acronym ever. It's that kid who's playing in the championship basketball game and they throw the winning basket right at the buzzer and then they just keel over, usually induced by the combination of exercise or, like, you know, increasing your heart rate plus an adrenaline surge. It's out of the blue. That's long QT syndrome. This takes months, this genetic testing. It takes months to get the answers back. And around her first birthday, I get a phone call. I knew I was in for bad news because it was the doctor on the phone. I have to tell you, we got her tests back and she is positive for long QT syndrome part one. She doesn't look like there's anything wrong with her, but she has this life-threatening condition where she could have a sudden death event, and she's completely unprotected. We were then on the way to Boston with our one-year-old to be seen by a pediatric electrophysiology team. At this point, I thought, okay, I have answers. They're terrifying answers, but at least I have them. And we're going to see the top pediatric electrophysiologist on the East Coast. Finally, we're going to get the answers. And we see him, and he's an amazing doctor, and he looks just like Santa Claus, which my daughter loves. He doesn't have the answers. You know, this is so rare, this combination of bradycardia and long QT, that he really doesn't have anything else to give us to protect her, except to say, you guys really should be carrying AEDs around with you wherever you go. And an AED is an automatic external defibrillator, but we don't have $4,000 to $5,000 just hanging around to buy AEDs. So I organized a physical fundraiser, not an online fundraiser, where we had like a hot dog fundraiser. Like we sold hot dogs and we had a raffle. My husband and I feel like we are failures. We've failed our child because we cannot provide for her something that she needs because we just don't have $4,500. And the humiliation is that we both have jobs. We even have good health insurance. But none of that is enough to provide the thing that our child needs most to be safe. Don't get me wrong. The vast majority of our family and friends were nothing but kind and helpful and giving and wonderful to us and supportive. But there were people who said to us that we were using our child's illness to gain something. And I cannot tell you how heartbroken we were. Well, I'll have to say I was heartbroken. My husband was angry. And then the guilt of every time you do something that involves money after the fundraiser, there's this feeling of like Should I not be spending money because people gave me money to buy AEDs? We have never taken a vacation with our children because we feel this sense of guilt, like someone might judge us. So we knew that the long QT syndrome was genetic. It came from a combination of a major gene mutation in my DNA makeup and a minor gene mutation in my husband's genetic makeup. So the combination of those two genes was inherited by my daughter, but not by my son. So when we went to see the pediatric electrophysiologist in Boston, I said to him, I had been thinking about a third and wanting a third, but I didn't want to be irresponsible. So I said to him, like, should we stop? And he said, no, don't. If you want a third, have a third. He's like, you know, people have so many different kinds of weird things. He's like, if it wasn't long QT, it might be asthma. If it wasn't asthma, it could be epilepsy. If it wasn't epilepsy, it could be diabetes. If it wasn't diabetes, you know what I mean? The list of things that could happen genetically is, you know, it's a lottery. The chance that another of our children would have the same combination of genes is only 25%. First time we tried, we got pregnant with number three. I convinced myself, this baby is going to be healthy. This baby is going to be genetically just as healthy as my son. We're not going to have to worry about it. They put the ultrasound wand down on my belly and her heartbeat came up on the screen, strong and steady at about 80 beats per minute. It was hard. It was difficult because I knew what we were in for. And then I went to bed that night. The night I had my third child, I fell asleep. You know, I was exhausted. I woke up at about 3 a.m. in the midst of a panic attack. It felt as if I was underwater and someone reached in and yanked me out of the water. And I couldn't breathe. My mind was spinning out of control. My heart was pounding. So that became a downward spiral again. This time, instead of crying all the time, I was having panic attacks regularly. For anyone who's ever had a panic attack, it feels like I'm dying when I have one. Like, it feels like what I imagine dying would feel like. I would pick crying over that any day. It feels almost like waves of fear running through my body. The fear I feel of the panic attack makes it even worse. It feels like my lungs are being constricted. It's excruciating. I've had some very painful things, like, physically happen to me in my life. I've had many surgeries. I would choose physical pain over a panic attack anytime. It feels like I am never going to be able to get out of this spiral. It's a complete loss of control. It's pretty devastating to find out that what you thought you knew is completely wrong. There is always that in the back of our minds that, could this be the day? Could this be the day that someone jumps out and scares her and she is gone? Or could it be this? Could it be today? In order to function in life, I can't allow myself to think that way. I have to force myself to treat our daughters the same way I treat our son. I have to say, we do live a fairly normal life. You know, my daughters do have restrictions. They will never be able to play varsity sports, or they can't ride roller coasters. They're not supposed to wake up to alarm clocks, or we can't take them into, like, haunted houses or on haunted hayrides. So, you know, Halloween tends to be a nerve-wracking time of year for me, because, and you go trick-or-treating and they freaking jump out at you in some scary zombie outfit, and then my kid, you know, could die from that. I can't prevent, you know, life from happening around them, so I just have to let it go. I have had horrible guilt because of the fact that it's my genes that passed along the mutant DNA that caused the long QT.
if I had said I'm not going to have children because there's the possibility that I could pass along long QT syndrome, I wouldn't have my three beautiful children. And what would I do without them? And I have to say, it's me, because I have long QT syndrome too. I didn't know I had it until my daughter was diagnosed, but I didn't find out until I was 33 years old that I have long QT syndrome. And look at me, I've spent my whole life, 33 years, not knowing, and have lived an amazingly wonderful life. Life saying to me, your whole life you've been in control and you've been an A-type personality and you've wanted to plan everything down to the minute, but that's not realistic. I'm going to give you two kids who prove to you that you can live life and let go of the reins. I didn't think I could live without knowing what was coming around the bend, without planning. And I can.